Well, convincing presentations should always end with a quote, they say. And I had a great Bertolt Brecht quote lined up, but damn that tradition. I'm going to start with a few quotes which I think really inform any serious understanding of the welfare state. So, quote number one, what ransom will property pay for the security it enjoys? Okay, and quote two, oh, I should have said, 50 years separates these two statements. But it really sounds like the question of the first quote is actually answered by the second quote, but I'll come back to that later. So quote number two, I would be willing to part with half of what I had if I could be sure of keeping under law and order the other half. Cool. Now I'll come back to explain those statements later in the talk, but try to keep them in mind as we go. I'll certainly bring them up a few times. So welfare states across the world have been under attack economically and ideologically for most of the last 40 years. Any decent person can understand that when single parent benefits are cut or funding to hospitals and schools are reduced, then the lives of working class and poor people suffer. But to understand why these attacks are happening and what can be done to stop them, we need to understand on what basis the welfare state exists in the first place. And in a capitalist world system based on, as Marx put it, accumulation for accumulation's sake, it can seem unclear why the rich and powerful bother to let any of the profits created in society be spent on welfare. So today I'm going to look at why welfare states came into existence, generally in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I'll use this explanation about why they exist, this framework, to look specifically at the development of welfare states in three countries: Sweden, England, and Australia. I'll talk about some of the problems of the welfare state. I'll then jump to the changes that occurred to welfare states during the 80s and 90s under the what's thought of as the neoliberal assault. And I'll close with what I think we should understand about the welfare state today. And I'll explore all of these questions from a Marxist framework. Marxists are the most committed defenders of the welfare state and also the people with a strategy to fundamentally change the economic and political system of capitalism, a social structure that systematically fosters inequality and throws so many lives onto the scrap heap in pursuit of profit and power for the few. Unlike most approaches to analysing welfare, Marxist theory places the welfare state in its wider social totality, an economic, political, and historical context which makes sense of the twists and turns in welfare development. Ian Gough, in his 1979 book, which we stole the name of for this session, wrote, "Marxists adopt a fundamentally different approach by treating the welfare state as a constituent feature of modern capitalist societies, situating the welfare state within its contemporary environment, the capitalist economy, and its attendant social relations." Cool. Good quote. So to clarify, today when I'm talking about the welfare state, I'm broadly referring to health, education, and welfare systems, most of which are provided in some way by the state. And most of the talk will focus on Europe and Australia, because these are easily the areas with the most developed welfare states. And you know, I hope the talk can offer an explanation for that. So, for instance, an international report from 2014 found that 80% of workers in Europe had some chance to access unemployment benefits. So 80% of workers in Europe. Guess what the percentage is in Latin America? 38%. In the Middle East, it's 21%. In Asia, it's 17%. And in Africa, only 8% of workers have some chance to access unemployment benefits. So that's kind of upsetting, but it also explains why my focus of my talk will be pretty narrow. So the welfare state is the result of two broad factors, because the welfare state serves multiple purposes. For working class people, education, welfare, and health services are a source of support, which should and sometimes do make our lives better. But the welfare state, as we know it, did not come about because it was good for ordinary people. For the capitalist class, the rich and powerful people who control most of the wealth in society, and specifically who own and control production, the impetus behind the establishment of a welfare state was their desire to maintain and reproduce the working class. Obviously, businesses which aren't profitable go under, and so capitalists are compelled by the need to make profits and compete with their economic rivals domestically and internationally. One of the key necessary factors in profit making is a capable workforce. And while one part of the capitalist brain says the ideal would be for workers to work for 24 hours a day and not cost anything to maintain, another part of the capitalist brain recognizes that this practice, whilst profitable at first, is obviously not sustainable. So, for instance, workers who have their basic health needs taken care of will take less time off work. They'll be able to work harder and faster and will be able to work productively until much later in life. In the earliest stages of the Industrial Revolution in England, as every man, woman, and child was thrust into endless hours of work in the booming mining and textile factories, life expectancy of workers in places like Manchester and Liverpool dropped to 16 years of age, so literally threatening to cut off the supply of labour that the employers needed. So for capitalists, having some of the profits of society, which could go into their own pockets, instead go into health and hospital services, for instance, that can make sense economically. They get a good return on their investment, if you like. Many industries require workers with high levels of knowledge and skill, which can be provided most efficiently through a mass education system. So again, capitalists can choose a strategy for profitability which sees them cede some of their profits to schooling and university systems which produce more skilled workers. Schooling also serves the purposes of freeing up more of the working class to be at work every day while children are supervised. And importantly, the education system plays a critical role in teaching children discipline and hierarchy, loyalty to the nation, and all the other ideas that capitalism relies on. You know, that this is a fair system, that there's no alternative to capitalism, that people who work hard are successful, and all the other rubbish. Of course, the working class does not only include people who are actually currently employed. It includes unemployed workers, retired workers, the children of workers, and the people who are incapacitated and unable to work. Unemployment benefits can sustain workers in between jobs or as a reserve army of labour that can be drawn back into the workforce when they're needed. State-provided or subsidised childcare can be necessary to free up adults to attend work, particularly women workers. And aged and disability pensions and supports also free up workers from caring roles and can help create ideological buy-in to the system. So ruling classes can pursue a strategy of investing money into the well-being of their working class, not so workers can enjoy a happy life, but so that they can be more productive at work. Profitability is the criteria, though. That's the question that gets asked and it's answered from their perspective. So whether the ruling class choose this strategy depends on many situational factors. First, are there profits to be made? In economic boom, more workers can mean more profits. If not, and there are more workers than the ruling class need, what Marx called a relative surplus population, like we see in many underdeveloped countries today, then why pay to sustain them? When economies go into recession, capitalists are less dependent on a supply of healthy workers. So who cares if a few get sick, end up on the streets or die? For example, the Greek hospital budget was cut by 25% in 2009, leading to outbreaks of once rare diseases like malaria and a massive spike in HIV. Another factor is immigration. Can immigration be high enough that it supplants some of the need to maintain the current workforce in good condition? If so, then maybe immigration rates need to be raised. Are birth rates high enough to ensure the next generation of workers? Maybe policies which encourage birth rates increasing are necessary. Can more of the burden of caring for children, the elderly and people with disabilities, be forced onto families, thereby replacing some of the requirements of the welfare state? If pensioners, retired workers mostly, are left to rot in poverty, then current workers may be less inspired to work for 40 years. If morale drops to the point where the working class feel no investment in how society is running, then they're less likely to be as productive. Having a healthy working class is not always about being fit to labour. Historically, having an unhealthy working class also threatened the capacity of capitalists to go to war for profits. England's efforts to mobilise for the Boer War in 1900 were hindered by the fact that 40% of those that enlisted were too malnourished for families for military service. Needing an adequate supply of labour means ruling classes have to weigh up all of the factors that I've mentioned and a whole bunch of other factors as well. They debate it out, and sometimes they can choose the strategy of investment in the welfare state, either for economic or ideological gains, as a means of integrating and controlling the working class, improving the profitability of the working class, or in order to reduce or head off working class discontent. Based on this factor alone, then, or this assessment, what is the welfare state? It is the combination of systems that the capitalist class developed to maintain and reproduce a profitable working class, and that takes different shapes. The second factor responsible for the creation of welfare states was the collective struggle of the working class in demanding improvements in their lives. This goes back to the earliest days of capitalism. England's Poor Law Acts from the 1300s up to the 1800s forced the unemployed poor into workhouses where they did manual labour but were fed and given basic medical care, basically though in prison conditions. The point of this was to reduce unrest and rebellion in the country and to compel people into paid work through fear of the workhouse. Later, the uprising of the Paris Commune in 1871 caused the German and Austrian governments to organise conferences to discuss questions such as workers' education, housing, women's and children's work, and unemployment insurance. These conferences were initiated by outright conservatives, you know, ruling class warriors, people like Bismarck, the Chancellor in Germany. But the threat of more uprisings like the Commune and increasing discontent in their own working class prompted these figures and their states to act to improve working class conditions. Germany's social insurance scheme in the 1880s, England's unemployment insurance scheme in 1911, Japan's first medical and financial support in the early 1920s, the sweeping welfare reforms in Sweden in the 30s, and example after example across the world. Welfare reforms followed from rising levels of industrial action, protests, riots, and armed clashes with the state. And these rebellions inclined the capitalists to raise the living standards of workers and the poor in hope that it would limit the disruption and protect the bulk of their wealth and privilege. Ruling class figures are sometimes honest enough to actually just say this out aloud for us to make this point. So returning to one of those quotes that I started with, what ransom will property pay for the security that it enjoys? That's Joseph Chamberlain. He was an MP in Britain in 1885, and he was president of the Board of Trade. And that's him basically arguing for welfare reforms. The Depression years in the US were followed by an inspiring upsurge of trade union struggle, which led to Roosevelt's New Deal, ushering in a framework for the modern US welfare state. A few years later, Joseph Kennedy Sr., one of the heads of the Kennedy Empire and the 10th richest person in the US during the Depression, he said, "In those days, I felt and said I would be willing to part with half of what I had if I could be sure of keeping, under law and order, the other half." Yeah. So for the ruling class, the loss of profits or social control or the reasonable threat of these things can prompt all sorts of concessions in order to maintain their overall control, particularly of industry and of state power. So those two factors can at times interact with each other. You know, the need for the capitalist class to maintain and reproduce a profitable working class, obviously at the lowest cost possible, and the tendency for the working class to fight for a better life. These dual factors were decisive in many developed economies following World War II. So in terms of the needs of capitalists, there was obviously a desire to rebuild their economies quickly after the disruption of the war, spurred on by the investments and technological advancements from the war and in preparation for the economic rivalry that the Cold War would bring. The social upheaval of the war impacted on the supply of workers in many countries, with around 60 million people killed, mostly working class people, but also enormous numbers of soldiers with disabilities returned home needing pensions and support, as did the children and widows of dead soldiers. The decentralization of state and economic power for the war lent itself to rolling out coordinated national health, education, and welfare schemes. And the influx of women into industry during the war also created the need for services which could fill some of the role that women had largely played caring for children, the aged, and people with disabilities. Then alongside these factors, workers and the union movements were well placed to wield power against the capitalists. Unemployment was very low due to the war. There were labour shortages, which increased the bargaining power of the unions. There was the recent experience of the Depression, which in places like Australia lasted for a decade and produced anger and radicalisation and struggle, and a sense of expectation as well that once the fascists were defeated, life would get better for workers. Strike levels were rising in some countries, even before the war ended, and capitalists could also remember the First World War, which ended with revolutions and general strikes sweeping the world. So it was the coming together of these factors which contributed to the expansion of the modern welfare state during this period, with widespread introductions of pensions, unemployment benefits, public housing, free education, universal healthcare, and so on. It's critical to understand the interplay of the two factors that I've focused on. For instance, if we don't recognise the role of workers' struggle in the introduction of welfare reforms, then we can just sit around today hoping that things magically get better or waiting for some mythical pro-welfare politician to get elected. Or if we don't understand that sometimes the ruling class can invest in the welfare state to boost their profits, then we can mistakenly think that the capitalists actually care about humanity, only to be confused when they introduce cuts later on. I want to work through several national case studies, but there are a few other important points worth summing up first. One, any reforms squeezed out of the ruling class are partial. Short of the most powerful threats to the capitalists, reforms that we win will be watered down and adapted to suit corporate interests. Even the most expansive welfare states have never abolished or even greatly reduced poverty or class divisions. They have not provided the self-determination that workers and the poor deserve. They have never abolished war, oppression, and destruction of the environment. Emphatically, they have not produced human liberation, and that is the actual goal of socialists. And two, any reforms wrung from the ruling class are also fleeting. This point, you know, hardly needs to be made today when we have seen waves of cuts and attacks on health and education and welfare over the last four decades. Everybody's pretty familiar with this. As soon as the capitalists think that they can get away with it, they go on the offensive to recoup whatever unwanted reforms they had conceded in previous years due to workers' resistance. As long as an exploitative minority control all of the decisions about production and control political power, the basic needs of the majority of people on the planet will never be prioritised. And obviously that's the case today. And that leaves no alternative, Marxists argue, but to overthrow the minority and create a society democratically run by the working class, the mass of people who already collectively produce everything with our labour, but who decide nothing and who struggle to live or who are simply left to die. Okay, I've tried to map out a general theory explaining the existence and dynamics of the welfare state. So let's see how this applies in the evolution of the welfare state in a few different countries. Now, no country is more closely associated with a strong welfare state than Sweden or Scandinavia more broadly, but there's nothing natural or timeless about welfare provision there. Sweden had a terrible history of poverty, hunger, and unemployment. A monarchy ruled the country until the 20th century. Emigration to other countries was illegal until the 1830s. In the 1860s, a famine led to the deaths of around 15% of the entire population. During the famine, exports of grain and cereal to Europe were booming, and millions of workers fled to countries like the US in the 19th and 20th centuries. The key period which saw the establishment of the Swedish welfare state was the early 1930s, and the decades leading up to it saw very high levels of working class organisation struggle. In 1902, workers held a three-day general strike demanding universal suffrage. In 1905, a general strike stopped a war of aggression with Norway and created a decisive threat of mutiny amongst the army. And in 1909, there was a month-long general strike for union rights. The First World War led to rapid industrialization in Sweden, and the working class in the cities grew in size and confidence. Strike levels remained high during the 1920s, and the union movement defeated a coordinated lockout by employers in 1925. As the Great Depression hit Sweden, workers resisted attacks on their wages and living conditions. After timber workers had been on strike for 8 months in 1931, Government soldiers opened fire on workers who were protesting against the use of scab workers to break the strike. Five striking workers were killed in the attack. The following day, a general strike broke out in cities across the country. In the city where the workers had been killed, 80,000 people protested and occupied a military training facility. Scab workers were not used again, and industrial action continued across the country. This was the context in which the Social Democrat Party was elected to power in 1932, introducing sweeping reforms including unemployment insurance, pension increases, shorter working hours for rural workers, mass public works programs, and annual leave allowances for all workers. Now, think back to the factors that I started with. Yes, there was a large-scale working-class resistance, a critical ingredient in welfare reforms of this scale. But think back also to that quote from Kennedy in the US at the same time, when he said, "I would be willing to part with half of what I had if I could be sure of keeping under law and order the other half." Cool. So that's clearly happening here. But Swedish capitalism could also incorporate these reforms into a strategy for profits. German industrial expansion in the 1930s, building up to the war, led to enormous increases in demand for Swedish exports, particularly in steel and timber. This trade fueled Swedish capitalism's need for an expanding workforce, and the welfare reforms could actually help to deliver that workforce. And the new profits helped to fund the cost of higher wages and welfare. Once the war began, most European economies were devastated, while Sweden remained neutral and expanded industrially, allowing them to play a disproportionate role in selling the materials which would rebuild other European nations that had been destroyed by the war. The long economic boom of the 50s and 60s provided incentives for Swedish capitalists to expand their working class by drawing women further into the workforce. So they introduced state-funded childcare, paid parental leave, abortion rights, and anti-discrimination laws. Added to the mix is the role of the Social Democrat Party. The strategy of these types of parties around the world, and the ALP is an example, is to cut a deal between the union movement, the working class, and the capitalist class, a deal which usually says to capitalists, we will run a profitable system for you by giving workers, potentially slightly higher living standards. But if profits are ever threatened, you can count on us to reduce workers' living standards, and we will successfully hold down the level of workers' resistance. And so during this period from the 30s to the 70s, the Swedish capitalists accepted this deal from the Social Democrat Party on the back of an unprecedented economic boom. The noticeable thing that the Social Democrats did not challenge or even threaten to challenge while in government was the right of capitalists to control industry, which is, obviously the fundamental source of their power. I'll come back to Sweden later on. As the first country where the capitalist mode of production was most clearly established, England introduced welfare reforms over a period of centuries. But it was the few years following the end of World War II which saw a wave of expansion of health, education, and welfare systems. The ruling class in England at the end of the Second World War faced a series of challenges, fearing similar uprisings to those that they faced at the end of World War I, when strike levels were high and the armed forces were at the point of mutiny. English capitalists were also eager to get business running quickly and smoothly again, and some sections of industry were developing the need for a more trained and educated working class. So there was a general consensus among the capitalists and the political parties on the need for investment in health, welfare, and education. Samuel Courtauld, head of a large textile company, said at the time, "Social security of this nature will be about the most profitable long-term investment the country could make. It will ultimately lead to a higher efficiency among workers and a lowering of production costs." So in this context, the Attlee Labour Party government nationalised 20% of the economy, including the Bank of England, coal mines, electricity and gas, railways and British Airways. Attlee created the National Health Service, the NHS, which guaranteed more or less free healthcare for everyone. Public housing expanded massively with 7 million new homes built in the 1950s and 60s, and a new system of benefits were introduced for families, pensioners, and others. The reforms were not without their weaknesses. For instance, the pensions were still inadequate, to be sure. They maintained people in poverty, basically, and the nationalised industries were still run by the same managers from the private sector. The welfare state strategy for profitability, agreed on among British capitalists and the political parties, depended on a growing economy. But economic crisis hit England in 1947. So in 1948, the Attlee Labour government began clawing back its own reforms, introducing a wage freeze for that year, talking about the need for workers to sacrifice, introducing taxes on goods and services, and abolishing the free dental and optometry services, which they had only introduced years before. The bulk of the reforms survived this period, though, and were maintained by the Tories as the economy picked up. But the small backlash in 1948 was an indication of what the capitalists would do if their profits did not justify the expenditure on the welfare state. The English capitalists were correct in their overall strategy, and industrial production doubled between 1946 and 1963. Importantly for them, the growth of the welfare state did not at all come out of their own pockets. In 1937, the richest 5% of people owned 79% of the wealth, and in 1960, that same 5% still owned 75% of the wealth. Unemployment did not rise above 3% until the 1970s, adding to rising living standards for workers, but also fueling the growing profits of the rich and paying for the extended welfare state. Okay, if England's welfare reforms of the 1940s were a watered-down version of the Swedish model, then Australia's reforms were even more partial. Small developments in the welfare state in the early 20th century had mostly been a strategy to buy social peace here, with significant strike levels in industries like the railways and the coal mines. Historian Stuart McIntyre explained that welfare reformers in early 20th century Australia introduced age-old pensions and maternity allowances, quote, because they considered it vital to national cohesion and purpose. The Harvester decision of 1907 established minimum wage rates to sustain a worker and their family. This decision was part of the National Industrial Arbitration System, which was established in response to the militant industrial struggles of the 1890s and with the intention of reducing strike levels and keeping the machines running. The Harvester decision to provide a wage with the explicit purpose of it paying for healthcare and supporting a family was a different solution to the same challenge for the capitalist class, how to provide for the maintenance and reproduction of a section of the working class, as well as, you know, as reducing the threat of rebellion. The Depression hit Australian workers very hard, with official unemployment climbing over 30% in 1932. In a period when workers' living standards were being smashed by a capitalist class on the rampage, the Communist Party of Australia took on the incredible task of unionising thousands of unemployed workers who were forced to work for the dole building public works. One spectacular example was an 8-week strike of workers building the Melbourne Shrine. As part of their stop work action, the unemployed workers held protests and occupations in the city on the biggest shopping nights, forcing the largest stores to close and lose thousands of pounds in profits. The Melbourne Herald ran front page articles demanding action, and the government conceded to pay rises of around 50%. And similar victories occurred for unemployed workers elsewhere in Victoria and New South Wales. That's pretty awesome. Again, coming out of World War II, working class struggle forced concessions from the ruling class. In Australia in 1942, there were less than 200,000 strike days. In 1945, so, you know, while the war continued, 500,000 strike days were lost. And in 1946, there were 1 million strike days. So a sharp increase. The Labor government introduced widows' pensions in 1942 and funeral benefits in 1943. And in 1945, the first national unemployment and sickness benefits were introduced. Like most other developed nations, Australia's economy entered a long boom after the war. And in the immediate context of low unemployment, high strike levels, and rising productivity, the ruling class consented to investments in health, education, and welfare, introducing free medical services for pensioners in 1951, government rent assistance in 1958, and improving the rates and accessibility of most benefits during the 1960s. The Commonwealth Child Care Act was introduced by the Liberals in 1972, and free university education and Medibank, later Medicare, were introduced shortly after by the Labor Party. Notably, both the Liberals and Labor during the boom invested in the welfare state. bipartisan support for ruling class strategy. The profits being made during this post-war period necessitated the growth of the workforce, so many policies were aimed at drawing women into the workforce, expanding tertiary education to develop a more skilled and profitable working class, and at the same time, massively increasing immigration levels, particularly of skilled workers. Okay, so these three case studies illustrate the rules that I started with, explaining why the welfare state exists. There are clearly local differences in what policies are introduced, the exact nature of them, and the timelines in which they are brought in, and particularly how directly the capitalists take responsibility for maintaining and reproducing the working class. In Sweden and Britain, to a degree, the state coordinates most of these systems on behalf of capital. In Australia, the minimum wage was set quite explicitly to allow the working class to pay for their maintenance and reproduction. Alternatively, in places like the US, which I would have loved to have spoken more about, the biggest companies in the 1930s and 40s were forced by a tremendously powerful union movement to provide basically mini welfare states to their employees, providing things like medical and dental, life insurance, retirement pensions, childcare benefits, and so on in their actual industry collective agreements. So again, that's a different approach, a different answer to the same question. So there are important differences in how it happens, but there are indisputable patterns in the dual underpinning dynamics of what policies best provide the capitalist class with a stable and profitable working class, and what pressure is being exerted by workers against the capitalists, forcing them to grant concessions that improve the lives of workers. Now, before I move on, I want to emphasize that while we're right to look back at better health, welfare, and education systems from the past as something better than what we have today, we can't have any romantic illusions that they were adequate. So first of all, I made the point earlier that the welfare state did not abolish poverty or inequality, and this is not an accident. Welfare provisions are calculated to never give someone a better life than if they were working the shittest job, because driving people into unsatisfying work, which makes someone else rich, that's what capitalism is all about. That's the whole point. And the meaning of being poor or working class and accessing the welfare state, the stigma that's attached, has always been made really clear. Sir George Nicholls, one of the three lords who implemented England's poorhouse laws, said, quote, "I wish to see the poorhouse looked to with dread by the labouring masses, by the labouring classes, and the reproach for being an inmate of it extended down from father to son. For without this, where is the needful stimulus to industry?" What a prick. So literally, anyone on welfare should be degraded and feel worthless, and that humiliation should be felt by their children. That was the plan. So that stigma will always accompany welfare payments, and you don't have to go far to see it today. The federal government website that promotes the Liberals' income management policy explains that it, quote, "helps people manage their welfare payments, encourages socially responsible behaviours, and protects vulnerable Australians," end quote. So translation, helps people manage their welfare payments, you know, that means because they're stupid, encourages socially responsible behaviours, that means because they're lazy and they're obviously leeching off the rest of us, and it protects vulnerable Australians. I can't even understand the spin of that part. Maybe it protects vulnerable Australians from being able to pay their bills and eat three meals a day. I don't know. Okay. So actually, in reality, the Australian capitalist class hate vulnerable Australians because they don't generate profits. And nobody thinks, you know, that the Liberal Party and their billionaire mates are the embodiment of socially responsible behaviours. Even more than that, the welfare state is designed to shape the lives and consciousness of workers and the poor. So it actively represses and divides and demonises whole sections of the working class. Welfare agencies, schooling, the probation system all contain, by design, systems which coerce and dehumanise poor people in the interest of the rich. Access to benefits and pensions have always been reserved for the right kind of poor people, you know, the poor who live in the right kind of families, the poor who abide by capitalist laws, which are designed to hold us down, the poor who don't speak up or fight for something better. And so immigrants and refugees are consistently denied full access to the welfare state because they were born in the wrong place. Gay and lesbian and trans people have consistently been denied access and support because they're outside the nuclear family. Striking workers are consistently denied benefits because they should be punished for standing up to their bosses. And poor families are consistently forced to allow state workers to scrutinise their homes and their family lives before they're deemed deserving of the economic support that they need to survive. And welfare provisions also reinforce the often crushing obligation of care forced on individuals for supporting children, the elderly, and people with disabilities when these responsibilities can and should be met collectively. So the point here is to emphasise that we should fight for whatever improvements we can in health, education and welfare, because the state of these systems and how they operate shapes our lives. But we can't be sucked into thinking that they can ever adequately give the mass of people the life that we deserve when at the end of the day, it's a capitalist system and the ruling class still gets to call the shots. Okay, so back to the history. What changed in the 1970s? The short answer is that the world economy entered a crisis which ended the 25-year boom and produced high unemployment and inflation, reducing the rate of profit. The ruling class suddenly had less need to maintain and reproduce the working class. To the degree that the rich still needed a healthy workforce, they would squeeze more profit out of workers than before, boosting the retirement age and compelling single parents, the unemployed, and people with disabilities to work for their pensions. And they would put as much of the cost of the welfare state onto workers as possible. This involved cuts to spending, the privatisation of services, competitive tendering and outsourcing of government services to drive down wages, ideological attacks on the government provision of services, mass layoffs in health, education and welfare, more punitive and repressive welfare conditions, and enormous increases in productivity and workloads. Neoliberalism was the name given to these policies, and again, you know, politicians of all stripes loyally adhered to the attacks that were demanded by the ruling class. So Labour in office in the UK from 1976 to 1978 cut public spending by an incredible 9.5%. Welfare was slashed, tens of hospitals were closed, school and housing funding were cut, and wage restraint policies were introduced. Cuts to funding were accompanied by ideological attacks designed to undermine support for the welfare state and to criminalise poverty while expanding police powers and increasing incarceration rates. So Bruce Anderson, an advisor to prime ministers in England in the 80s and 90s, he explained that welfare in the post-war period had, quote, constructed slums full of layabouts and sluts, whose progeny are two-legged beasts. We cannot cure this by family, religion, and self-help, so we will have to rely on repression. End quote. What a wonderful time that was. Okay, and then, well, yeah, prison populations around the world also grew enormously during this period, with almost 7 million people in the US in jail or on parole or probation today. So that's one in 35 Americans. The Whitlam Labor government in Australia in 1974 began attacking militant unions and dole bludgers in their speeches, and their 1975 budget froze wages at the same time that it cut corporate taxes and boosted corporate subsidies. Welfare spending was cut, as were education and social services. The same Labor Party, which gave us free education in 1974, abolished free education in 1989. The ABS website today, which lists the history of pensions in Australia, has an intro to the 1970s onwards where it says, quote, "The earlier part of this period saw an expansion of existing provisions. The latter part has been one of consolidation and rationalisation." Great. So that very euphemistically sums it up. In Sweden, sweet, pure model of the welfare state, Sweden, the exact same pattern was repeated. So privatisation and deregulation have been, particular features of the welfare state since the 1980s. The number of people employed in the government sector in Sweden has dropped by nearly 20% in the last 30 years. And in the last two decades in particular, income and wealth inequality has grown faster in Sweden than in any other OECD country, largely attributed to the reduction in state benefits and a shift toward the privatisation of public services. The Swedish welfare state is still clearly stronger than others, not least of all because union density is still higher in Sweden, but the negative trends are the same as elsewhere. Okay, how do we explain these changes? So the starting point is the changing needs of capital. Lower profit rates globally have reduced the need for capitalists to maintain and reproduce the working class. Yeah, Marx's relative surplus population. The strategy of investing in the welfare state for higher profits, the strategy often attributed to the social democracy type parties, was dependent on healthy economies. But the growth of a capitalist economy is an inherently unstable and unplanned process that inevitably degenerates into crisis. And right now, there's still no end in sight to the global recession, which began 9 years ago. As we've seen, the welfare state strategy was also backed up by pressure from organized and militant working class movements. Part of the betrayal of the social democracy parties over the last 40 years is that they have often implemented the cuts to the welfare state themselves. But probably worse is that they have used their influence in the working class, often through their control of trade unions, to convince workers not to fight, that we need to act reasonably towards the capitalist class rather than organize to fight them, that these cuts are unavoidable, and that we should rely on electing labor to stop the cuts, which they do not do. So, seeming to confirm then this powerlessness that the Labour Party preaches, the ruling class has been far more determined to not concede, to struggle. So the enormous resistance of the Greek working class in recent years, with very little gain, indicates how far the rich are willing to go to make us pay, and the scale of uprising that it would take to win what we need. Okay, so these developments then raise the question, can capitalism abolish the welfare state? Well, anyone working in health or education or welfare today can look around and feel like the government just doesn't give a shit about whether the services actually get delivered or not. You know, you look at the billions cut from the hospital system, or how badly funded and resourced public education is, or public housing, for God's sakes. The federal budget from Tony Abbott in 2014 and the productivity reports which informed it gave us an insight into what big business in Australia desires. You know, billions cut from health, billions out of education, the dole abolished for unemployed youth, cuts to aged pensions, the abolition of the minimum wage. And, you know, the attacks in many other countries are even worse than that. But if the capitalists around the world want to abolish the welfare state altogether, they're actually having a very difficult time of it, because they still need to grapple with maintaining and reproducing a profitable working class. And sometimes the capitalist class faces active resistance, and they often fail to undermine the ideological commitment to the welfare state that many working classes still maintain. So these factors explain why, despite the rhetoric and the desire from the rich to cut back spending and services in health, education and welfare, the general rule over the last several decades is that they have not been able to cut overall funding and restructure the welfare state as they have wanted to. But they won't stop trying, obviously, and in the event of a serious economic collapse, we should expect to see the kind of catastrophic cuts that we've seen in places like Greece in recent years. What we clearly see are consistent restructures and recommissioning. Some services get defunded, others get partially funded. This constant sort of shuffling around, all the while searching for the perfect balance of as little funding as they can provide for a working class that functions at the level that they need and who isn't about to rise up and disrupt everything. So looking ahead, our attitude should include a determined opposition to every assault on health and education and welfare, whether it takes the shape of funding cuts or productivity drives or simple ideological attacks. Of course, we should always demand more. We live in one of the richest countries in the world, and most areas of society, particularly social services in Australia, is stretched to breaking point. Along with funding, we should also demand the local control of welfare provision, with workers and students, patients and welfare recipients having real decision-making power over the services that they work in and the support that they receive. But considering the long-term capitalist crisis that we are in, when the explicit strategy from above is to launch one assault after another on the welfare state, protecting what we have or winning improvements will require massive social movements and a very high level of working class militancy. We should support calls for a return to better welfare state policies while remembering that the capitalists won't concede a better life for workers without a significant threat to their profits and their power. And of course, a decent society, a socialist society, where the mass of people actually have real democratic control over industry and social policies, could actually end the poverty and the disempowerment that capitalism creates and thrives on. Thanks.